The Buddha said that all he taught was dukkha and how to end it. Dukkha, of course, is the word that we usually translate as suffering, but that only works if we understand it in the broadest possible sense, right? Not just physical and mental pain, but also dissatisfaction, anxiety, dis-ease, and a new term that I'm hearing now, sometimes stress. So dukkha includes stress. And what I would like to talk about this evening is one particular cause of stress for us, that is to say, time, our usual way of understanding and experiencing time. Time as a cause of stress or as a cause of dukkha, there's a couple different ways that we can, a couple different aspects that we can focus on. I think the most obvious one is what's sometimes called time compression, the fact that many of us feel that we just don't have enough time to do all the things that we'd like to do. I notice all the gray hairs here, and I think that many of you, like me, are retired, so maybe it doesn't work in quite the same way once you've retired and once the kids are off to college or whatever, but still, I don't think those of us who are older are immune from this either. I recently read a statistic that was comparing the number of people who felt that they were always rushed, that they always felt rushed, not just that they sometimes felt rushed, but they always felt rushed. And within like a 22-year period, it went up from like 22% to 37% or something like that. And that was back in the 90s. So my guess is it's much worse nowadays. But this phenomenon of feeling squeezed is, I think, a real cause of stress, right? And stress as one form of dukkha. This is a problem not only individually, but collectively, in the sense of how we have to work these days, or how we often end up working. Turns out that Americans not only work many more hours than most Europeans do, on average, but we also work more hours than the Japanese do. Yeah. I was quite surprised to read that as well. This is tied up with many other things as well. Sleep deprivation, burnout, right? Workaholism, sometimes death from overwork, at least that's very common in Japan. Lack of time for family and friends. A writer, Robert Levine, said, "Time may have become the most precious commodity in the land." This was, again, back in a 1997 book. "Time has become the most precious commodity in the land." Is there something weird about that? It's like, you know, when I think of commodities, I think of oil, you know, sugar, rice, coffee, time. It doesn't quite fit in there. Is maybe the problem, part of the problem, the way that we're thinking of time as a commodity? Or let's take another example here, which I think is something that sort of fits for a lot of us. Thinking of our time is like a big container, like a big bucket, and there's only so much of it. And the problem with time compression, the problem with stress, is that the bucket or the container just isn't big enough for all the things that we want to kind of stuff into it, right? Does that ring a bell? Does that connect? Yeah. But what if the problem isn't that our container isn't big enough? What if the problem is that we're thinking of time as a container. And this is the point of the kind of Buddhist approach that I want to talk about this evening. When we normally experience time and think of time, we just think that we experience time as it is. It's just that we don't have enough of it. But from a Buddhist point of view, actually, time is one of those things that in fact we are understanding and experiencing in a delusive way. Buddhism sometimes talks about two truths or two aspects of reality, two ways of experiencing reality. And the point that I'm going to try to explain today is that our normal way of experiencing time, which seems very natural to us, that's just what time is, in fact, it's a social construct, a psychological construct. We've learned to see time as a commodity. We've learned to experience it as a kind of container that's never big enough. And in fact, what's needed is not a bigger container, but in fact, learning to understand and therefore experience time in a different way, in a more non-dual way. Thinking about time as a container, that we never have enough of it, one of our responses to that, of course, is that we try to save time as much as we can, right? Which reminds me of one of my all-time favorite books, which I left in the bag. Momo, anybody know this book? It's a real classic. Strictly speaking, it's a children's book or maybe a book for young adults. But in fact, I think it's one of these timeless books that all ages can read and appreciate. It's by Michael Ende, the same guy who wrote The Neverending Story, which was made into a movie that I didn't like very much, but the book itself is actually fantastic. Anyway, the reason I mention Momo is that Momo is all about time and the problem with trying to save time. The basic plot is about this orphan girl named Momo who suddenly appears, and she has to struggle against the gray men or the gray gentlemen who are bankers. And this is like a kind of a myth or a parable, but the basic story is that they are bankers, but they don't deal in money, they deal in time. And what they try to do is they go around and they try to persuade everybody to save time. And the time you save, they will put it in their bank and you will receive more, you will receive interest on it. But not really, because it turns out that they're the time thieves, that all the time that people save, in fact, they smoke up or they use up. But in the process, what this book wonderfully demonstrates is the problem with saving time, because basically what happens is as they persuade more and more people to save time, society falls apart. My favorite example is Figaro the barber, okay? Their motto is, time is precious, don't waste it. Time is money, save it. And Figaro is one of their first victims. When he's in a bad mood, doubting the value of his existence, he's the perfect victim for their arguments and time-saving mathematics. So one of the gray men comes into his barbershop and persuades him to start saving time by eliminating all the activities that in reality are what give the meaning and the quality to his life, his social life, his reading, even his daydreaming. Suddenly he becomes future-oriented with disastrous consequences. Quote, the determination to save time now so as to be able to begin a new life sometime in the future had embedded itself in his soul like a poisoned arrow. Yet by changing his lifestyle, he was becoming increasingly restless and irritable. The odd thing was that no matter how much time he saved, he never had any to spare. In some mysterious way, it simply vanished. And his days grew shorter and shorter. And he, like other people, never seemed to notice that by saving time, they were losing something else. So it's a wonderful examination or a wonderful mythic or story way of sort of just looking at our obsession with saving time. A minute ago, I talked about the problem, how odd it seems to think of time as a commodity, but even to think of saving time, right? You can save money, put it in the bank or in your mattress. You know, you can save the leftovers from dinner, but what does it mean to save time? And why, from Enda's point of view and Momo's point of view, why doesn't that work? Will Rogers said, "Half of our life is spent trying to find something to do with the time we've rushed through life trying to save." He would have said that back in the 1930s. I expect it's a lot more true now, right? Why is that? But why is that? Because in the process of trying to save time, what we tend to end up doing is instrumentalizing time. We're always treating the present as something we can use in order to get something else, right? We're trying to accomplish as much as we possibly can in this time. And so even when we maybe get to the end of the chores that need to be done, that mentality of instrumentalizing the present still tends to continue. So that we don't know what else to do with the time when we have it. It also fits in with what I sometimes say about our sense of lack, that our sense of self is haunted or shadowed by the sense of lack, the feeling that something is wrong with me, something is missing, that we're not good enough. And that means that the present is uncomfortable just to be in the present, because that's when we feel it. So we tend to become preoccupied with the future, because it's by accomplishing things now, instrumentalizing the present, we hope to fill up our sense of lack so that sometime in the future, everything will be okay. But it's always in the future, you see. It's always losing the present for the sake, sacrificing the present for the sake of the future. Pascal, the great French philosopher, said, all our miseries derive from not being able to sit in a quiet room alone. Why not? He also said, we don't rest satisfied in the present, for the present is generally painful to us. What might become apparent? Well, first of all, what's necessary to change in order for the present not to be so painful so that we can reside into it? What would we experience about the nature of the present if we were able to do that? When the Buddha was asked why his disciples were so radiant, he replied, "They don't repent of the past, nor do they brood over the future. They live in the present. Therefore, they are radiant." By brooding over the future and repenting the past, fools dry up like green reeds cut down in the sun. So that's one of our problems with time, which is definitely connected, I think, with the particular way of understanding it, and I'm going to be going more into that. But I don't think that's the main problem. Our problem isn't simply that we don't have enough time, but that we can't have enough time. As self-conscious human beings, we know that we weren't always here, and we know that we won't always be here. That is to say, we know that we're going to die. And that's something, needless to say, that's very, very uncomfortable for most of us, right? And let's be frank. I think this is one of the main motivations or one of the main reasons why religion is so important to people. Because for many or most religions, one of the really important things they do is that they reassure us that when we die, we don't really die. Or that is to say, maybe the body will die, or definitely the body will die, but something like the soul or spirit, something will continue, something will persevere. And so we have this great desire for immortality. So, for example, in, say, some very traditional kinds of Christianity, the soul is immortal, and of course what we do here is so important because it determines whether this immortality will be spent in God with heaven or in a more uncomfortable place. Right? So we can understand how our fear of death, which so often poisons life for us, this is the other thing that existential psychologists talk about, so often our fear of death is also our inability to live fully. But we tend to understand the solution as immortality. If we could just keep living on and on and on and on. But it's this really interesting question. Would immortality really be the solution to our problem? I'm thinking of something Susan Ertz said. Millions of people long for immortality who don't know what to do with themselves on a rainy Sunday afternoon. There's also a wonderful, very short story by Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentinian writer. He wrote a little story called The Immortal. And it's quite a precious little story. In the first half of the story, there's this Roman military guy who is looking for the famous spring where if you drink from the spring, it will make you immortal. That's the first half of the story. Anybody want to guess what the second half of the story is? He's trying to find the spring that will enable him to die. Would immortality really be the solution? Let me read you something by a philosopher named Carse. Well, before I get to him, is eternity in the way we usually understand it, an immortality that just goes on and on forever? Is that what we really want? Wouldn't life eventually become a burden that we would want to become rid of? And then Carse says, if the future is opened indefinitely, the focus, the pressure is taken off the present. There's nothing that cannot wait. For example, maybe I want to learn Chinese or piano. In fact, it'd be great to know both, but know how to play the piano, I'd love that, and speak Chinese. But I also know it's going to take a great deal of effort to do that, right? A lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of work. But hey, I've got infinite time, right? So what's the big deal? It's like, where would the motivation come from, you see? Like opening a sealed vessel to an infinite vacuum, the elements of life would kind of blow out in all directions. What does it matter how the first several acts of the drama develop when there's an endless number of acts to come? How can it be a drama at all? Life would have no risk. Nothing would be at stake. Maybe even our personality structure wouldn't sort of function in that kind of situation. And I think he's got a point there. He's really pointing to some problem, that this way of understanding the problem of death, the kind of immortality that just goes on and on and on and on, maybe that wouldn't be the solution. So here, I want to make a distinction between immortality, which literally means not, right? Immortality, not dying. If you're immortal, you don't die. In fact, that has a very different meaning from another word that we usually think is the same, eternity. Anybody know what the etymology or the meaning of eternity is? Literally, it's going back to the source, right? Literally, it means without beginning and without end. It's not talking about death at all. It's talking about no beginning or no end. That is eternity. And what is how to say it? Can we think of something that is without beginning or end? Sorry? Mobius strip, good. Darn it, that's not what I was looking for. But something more pertinent to today's talk. I fear it may someday have an end. It may not be a good one, but who knows? Yeah, yeah. Actually, you know, what I'm thinking of here is the now. And it's interesting, isn't it, that sometimes mystics talk about the eternal now. What the heck? What can that possibly mean? Again, to go back to what I said at the fore before, our normal way of understanding time, our normal way of understanding the relationship between past, present, and future, is in fact a construct. It's a particular way of thinking. It's a particular way of understanding that we have learned, we have been socialized into as we grow up. But in fact, it's not the only way to experience time. In fact, there's a problem with it. Our usual way of understanding now, when we think of the now, we think of it as just this thinnest possible dividing line between the infinity of past, right? And the infinity of future. So it's like the now, you can parse it finer and finer and finer. Maybe now they can do billionths of a second. I think they had to do something like that to actually detect gravity waves, right? But so this is our normal way of understanding the now, right? We can watch the second hand go around in a clock, right? But is the now, in fact, something that constantly falls away and becomes the past? We understand it that way when we're instrumentalizing the present, trying to get something out of it, trying to use it, rather than being in the present. Our future orientation means the now is always constantly falling away. But Wittgenstein, the philosopher, put it very well. He said, "If by eternity we mean timelessness, then eternal life belongs to those who live in the present." Can we experience the now in a different way? Can we experience the now, the here and now, as something that does not fall away? Isn't the nature of the now that it's always now? It's amazing what some of the mystics have said about this, right? Jakob Mumma, the great German mystic, said, "He to whom time is the same as eternity, and eternity the same as time, is free from all contention." Joshu, the great Chinese master, "Even before the world was, this reality is." Another Chinese master, Huang Bo, "Beginningless time and the present moment are the same. You have only to understand that time has no real existence." And according to Rumi, the great poet, "A true Sufi is called a son of the moment. He's not of time. The past and the future and time without beginning and time without end do not exist." What are they all talking about? They're all pointing to this other kind of eternity that's sometimes called the eternal present. And so what I'd like to do is spend the rest of my time sort of trying to give us some sense of what that means. It's interesting, first of all, in Buddhism, right? Buddhism, by its critique of the self, by its denial of the self, it's not playing that common religious game of saying that we are immortal. It's not about that at all. There are a couple places in the earliest teachings in the Pali Canon where the Buddha talks about the deathless. But it's interesting, there's a lot more about the unborn. Remember, eternity, no beginning, no end. And there's a lot of talk in Buddhism about the unborn. There's a couple very famous passages where the Buddha says things like, there's an unborn and unoriginated, etc., etc. It's because of that that there's an escape from the born and so forth. And what I sometimes wonder if somehow what's happened in a lot of, in I sometimes wonder that's what happened in the tradition and the way that many Buddhists understand the Buddha. When he's talking about the unborn, maybe he doesn't mean that literally in the sense of the goal of the practice being to die and not be reborn back into this world of samsara. Again, it's very important how literally we take that or how metaphorically we understand that. Because in the Mahayana tradition, for example, we also find the word unborn used, and it's very clear that they're not talking about the end of physical life and not being reborn after that. They're talking about something that can be experienced right here and now. For example, Yongcha, since I abruptly realized the unborn, I've had no reason for joy or sorrow at any honor or disgrace. Huh? Abruptly realizing the unborn. And there was the great Japanese Zen master Bankei, that was his fundamental teaching. He was on the edge of death from tuberculosis when he had this sudden realization about the nature of the unborn. Suddenly, just at that moment it came to me, I realized what had escaped me until now. All things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. When you dwell in the unborn itself, you're dwelling in the very wellhead of Buddhism patriarchs. The unborn is the nature of the Buddha mind. It's not talking physically about what happens after we die. It's saying something about how we can experience here and now. The last talk I gave here a couple months ago, I think probably some of you were present for that. It was in the next room. And I talked about non-duality. Non-duality literally means not two. And it's a very common theme in Buddhism and lots of other mystical or religious spiritual traditions. What it really points to is that two things that we tend to think of as separate from each other, in fact, they're not separate at all, that they're interdependent, that they're somehow two sides of the same thing. And in a way, this relates very closely to what I said a minute ago, that we learn to experience time in a certain way. In particular, the duality here that we've all learned, that we all take for granted, is the duality between ourselves and time as something external, a container, something that's outside us, something that has a reality or a being of its own. And so that's the sense that we get sometimes, that we're trapped, that time is out here and there's just not enough time to do what we want to do. And worse than that, the fact that we know that our time is going to come to an end. And so there's this sense of entrapment. So here's the duality, the sense of me and you, the sense of ourselves as being in time. And that's the delusive duality that we need to deconstruct. Because it's by deconstructing that that we can come to experience time in a different way and experience what is sometimes called the eternal present. The point of this is something like this. You and I are not in time because we are time. Our being is basically temporal. And because we are time, we cannot be trapped by time. There's a dialectic. Now, it's through our practice, it's through our meditation, it's through letting go of ourselves and forgetting ourselves in our practice that we can come to experience this. But nonetheless, there's something of great value, I think, that can help if we sort of go through this process of trying to explain the relationship between ourselves and this supposedly external time. In other words, what I'm really talking about is what might be called deconstructing the delusive sense of separation between ourselves and time. A delusive separation that's also a cause of dukkha, as I've tried to explain. Because if we think of time as something outside ourselves, then it's something that's limiting us. It's something that's in some way trapping us. So we need to do two things. First of all, realize the sense in which time is not something outside us. We ourselves are fundamentally temporal. And I think the best way to do that is to start with the kind of spatial metaphor, right? So looking at this, for example, looking at this bell, we normally would say something like the bell is on something, the bell is on the desk, the bell is in my hand. The point of all of those being that the bell is in space, right? The bell is in space. All of us are in space. Those chairs are in space. Each of us here, we are in space. But if you think about it, if you think of the bell as something in space, it suggests or implies that you could take it out of space. Well, where could you take it that it was going to be out of space? In fact, when you think about it a little bit, you realize, well, it's not so much that the bell is in space, but the bell is inherently spatial, right? If you think about it, all these spatial relationships, the curvature, the bottom, the inside and the outside, all of these relationships which are spatial are necessary in order for it to be a bell. And the point I'm making here is simply that it's not so much that the bell is in space, but we could say it's a certain form that space is taking, right? Maybe Einstein, I don't know, is this what Einstein was talking about, you know? Our problem with time is we tend to think of time in a Newtonian sense, time as sort of external objective. But it was Einstein who talked about space and time. And I think he would be comfortable saying, you know, just as gravity is kind of a warping of space and time, so in a way everything is a manifestation of space and time. And that's my essential point here about time. I just tried to say something about this being inherently spatial. And the same thing is true for time if you think about it. Can you think of yourself as outside of time? Where would you go? What would that mean? What would that involve? Isn't it the case that our being is inherently temporal? So it's not that things have any self-existence of their own that's separate from time. Everything is essentially in its own nature spatial and temporal. One of the really important implications of this, of course, fitting in with what Buddhism generally says about impermanence and insubstantiality, the world is not a collection of separate self-existing things that just occasionally interact or bump into each other. Rather, one way to express the point I'm trying to say is that everything is in fact a process. Some processes are a lot slower than others. The process of a rock is a lot slower than, for example, this evening's talk or a thought that may flit. But nonetheless, instead of the world being a collection of things, it's really a confluence of interdependent processes, right, that are constantly unfolding quickly or slowly. And by saying that, it means everything. So this wall, as I once said in an earlier talk, right, the wall is a process. It's not just a thing that's in space and time, it's temporal. It's atoms are not in space and time. Atoms are in and of themselves temporal. Everything is temporal. Does that make any sense? This is really important because if we understand it, it deconstructs that duality between things and time. Things are essentially temporal. And within the Buddhist tradition, the one particular teacher who talked most about this was the great Japanese Zen master Dogen. If you know anything about Dogen, you've probably heard about he has this really interesting concept called uji, which literally means being time. And we can make that into one hyphenated word, being time. For Dogen, the world isn't made up of things. Everything is being time, because you can't have being separate from time. There are really two ways of looking at the same thing. So Dogen is constantly, in his writings, very poetically, conflating the duality by saying that objects are time, or that time is objects. So he says, the time we call spring blossoms directly as an existence called flowers. The flowers, in turn, express the time called spring. You know, spring is not something, the blooming of the trees and the flowers is not something that happens in spring. The blooming of the trees and flowers is springtime itself, you see? If we really get a sense of that, then we are able to understand some of his really cryptic statements. For example, being time, Uji, being time here means that time itself is being, and all being is time. Each moment is all being, is the entire world. Time is not separate from you. And as you are present, time does not go away. Do not think that time merely falls away or flies away. You may think that, but you should understand that time never arrives. Again, if we're really in the eternal present, it's not something that falls away. It's not something that has a beginning. It's not something that has an end. It's just now. It's becoming aware of that which does not fall away, which does not come and does not go. People only see times coming and going and don't thoroughly understand that being time abides. It has this quality of flowing, he says. But the moments of past and present, they don't just kind of line up and they fall away. Don't think flowing is like wind and rain moving from east to west. The entire world is not unchangeable. It's not immovable. It flows, or as we might prefer to say, it's in process. So according to Dogen, time isn't something we have, but something we are. Time isn't something we're in, because it's not something outside of us. Everything is a process, and of course it's the nature of process that it is inherently temporal. It's not something in time. The process is, there's a time built into. Does it make any sense? You know, it's a little philosophical, sorry. But well, I'm sorry to say it's going to get worse right now, because I'm going to finish by doing the other side of the dialectic, if you will. Let me check the time. How are we doing? It's the eternal present we got all night and a lot more than that, right? Right? So, okay, this spurious, delusive duality where we think that we're things that have some kind of self-existence and we just happen to be in time and we're trapped by time. So what I've done so far is to say, what I've tried to do is I've tried to cite Dogen, I've tried to use the metaphor of space and all this, the analogy of space, to say, okay, we're not really in time, we are time, right? But now, the final point to make is, okay, if we're in time, then we can't be trapped by time. To completely be in time is to realize that which does not fall away, the eternal present. Or how do I say it here? How does realizing that we are time really free us from time? And here, excuse me, but a little more complicated metaphor here. Think of a rock, a tiny, rocky, barren island way out in the middle of the ocean, right? So there's this rock, but there's also this current that's going past it at a certain speed. So the rock, you could say, is us, our usual understanding of ourselves, and we're aware of this time flowing, right? Time flowing, time passing us, right? So there's a what I'm doing is, this is a duality between us and time, the rock and the current. But what I've just done earlier is saying there's really no rock there, right? There's really no separate self that's separate from time. There's really nothing there that's separate from the current. So now what we have is, instead of being a rock, now it's as if that all of us or each of us are like in on a little dinghy, a little raft that's floating along with the current at the same speed as the current. What would your experience of the current be? Think of this. You're moving along at the same speed as the current, right? What's your experience of the current going to be? Well, you're not on the rock anymore, so it's not flowing past you, right? So what's your experience of the current? Nothing. Nothing. It's like, on the one hand, there's two things. On the one hand, there's a sense of timelessness, such as Wittgenstein was talking about. This eternal present. But nonetheless, the content of that eternal present is going to change. As Dogen said, it's going to flow. It's always going to be now, but the content of that now will flow naturally from one thing to the other. So that there will be a sense of timelessness to it. But a timelessness not in the sense of being oblivious or unaware of what's going on, but rather a timelessness in the sense that our lives flow naturally from this, to that. We're still always in the present. We're in the present that does not fall away. But the quality, the nature of that present is constantly flowing, constantly transforming. Because time is not only not something outside of ourselves, it's not only that we are time, but there's a sense that we are free from time because we are time. Does that make any sense? I mean, I don't know how much sense it can make apart from our practice. The point being, we have to, you know, we can get some sense of this, but I really think it's our practice where we let go of ourselves and we're able to let go of thinking of time as something outside of ourselves that we're trapped in, that we're always using. And again, maybe that's the essential point, that we're missing all this because in normal day-to-day life, we're constantly relating to the present moment as just this opportunity, something to use to get something else. So we're constantly sacrificing it in order to attain something in the future. And we're all so caught up in that, that we're constantly overlooking, missing something about the nature of now, which is to say that it's always now, that it's always been now, that it will always be now, and there's nothing to gain or to lose. This now is without beginning and without end, which is, as I said, the definition of eternity. Thank you.